Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and is starting a campaign to end all football matches after 91 minutes. You hear me? 91 minutes, no more.
You must feel pretty gutted after that.
Oh, that's one word for it. Luckily, the cat was upstairs. She seemed to sense something was happening. Not that I would ever harm the cat, listeners, of course. I love my cat. I'm Kevin Day, and he is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. How are you, Kieran?
I'm very good, thank you, Kevin. But I'm back in Liverpool teaching away, so I'm happy as I can be.
Good. And how was the Baroness after her gin weekend?
She came back with lots of recipes for various gin cocktails, and she is now looking for other places in the country that host gin tours, because she says it's her equivalent of collecting Panini cards. I think she wants to have a gin tour for every city in the country that possibly has a gin distillery there.
There's a lot of Panini cards out there, Kieran, if she's trying to keep up with that. Later in the show, we will hear from Tom Rawson, Head of Sustainability at Football for Future, a new charity with a mission to build a more environmentally sustainable culture in English football. He's also the first Chief Sustainability Officer in English football, possibly world football, I believe, for non-league Hanwell Town. We've got some news questions before that, though. News questions, news stories. But before that, some even more important news. You will remember the saga of the missing name from Sunday's Questions pod. We had a question without a name, and you and I, Kieran, we were reluctant to ask this question. And producer guy went, no, ask it. He cracked the whip. Don't worry about the name. Names are not important. They're just little people who provide us with questions. And we said, producer guy, that's not the attitude. We had a long discussion. But it's Barry Nicol. Barry Nicol is the man who sent in the question about Scunthorpe. So, Barry, if you're listening, you probably aren't now. I imagine you'd have taken umbrage after what producer guy said. But Barry Nicol was that question. And now, Kieran, news story. Is this the FIFA World Cup every 2 years story, Kieran, which we haven't really been taken seriously, has now had another comic twist?
It's now entered the realms of surreal. Gianni Infantino, who is the head of FIFA, he has been taking a fair amount of stick from UEFA. Now, ultimately, what we are seeing at present is a power struggle between FIFA and UEFA. UEFA make money every year from the Champions League and, to a lesser extent, from the Europa League. And, of course, they make money on top of that every 4 years from the European Championships. FIFA lose money 3 years out of four, but they make a lot of money from the FIFA World Cup. So Jenny's idea was to encourage, I think it's fair to say, a World Cup taking place every 2 years. UEFA are unhappy with this because the players are unhappy with this because how is it all going to be fitted in? The Olympic movement is unhappy with this because, you know, the Olympics takes place in the intermediary 2 years, in which the World Cup doesn't place. Yeah, can you have a World Cup and an Olympics back to back? It's going to squeeze it out. There's a lot of pushback. So Infantino, apparently in one of his meetings, came up with this, and I can only presume this is the equivalent of Alan Partridge's monkey tennis piece of, you know, sort of off-the-cuff idea of having a World Cup, but in order to give the players a bit more respite, you cannot play in it if you played in the previous finals. So
right,
it means you can only play in the World Cup once every 4 years. But it does mean, you know, let's say that a major country such as England or Spain or Italy or Germany or Brazil or Argentina, what happens if they didn't qualify for 1 year and they ended up in what can be broadly described as the World Cup equivalent of the Johnson's Paint Trophy. And then you get locked into that four-year cycle yourself. So it seems to be a completely harebrained idea. It will allow, you know, trying to be positive, it will allow, in theory, 80 countries to participate in the World Cup in the World Cup every 4 years. And, you know, at present it's 32. And, you know, you and I grew up when it was 16, and we thought that was quite exciting. It could also mean in that some countries might strategically fail to qualify if they're not that great a team, and then try to qualify for the weaker World Cup taking place in 2 years' time. So it's an amazing different idea, which appears to have given as much thought to it as some of my chat up lines in the pink coconut back in the 80s.
I'm surprised to hear there was any pre-thought put into them at all, Kieran, you being a man of such spontaneity. But you've hit the nail on the head with one of the things you said there, Kieran. You hit the nail on the head with everything you say. Of course you do. I was writing on Have I Got News For You yesterday, and it may surprise you, Kieran, that every now and again we put down the mighty pen of satire and talk about other things about once every 8 or 9 minutes, essentially. Frankly, there's only so many green renewal jokes you can write. But we talked about this, and then we talked about this idea, and nearly every single football fan said, but surely you're going to get countries jockeying to get into the B World Cup. You know, you're going to get countries who are trying tactically to avoid, because otherwise what you're going to have here is essentially every second year you'll have a World Cup with essentially championship countries.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Countries 1 to 40 in the FIFA rankings.
Yeah.
And then countries 41 to 80. You know, who's going to host it? Because is that going to attract big crowds when you've got Albania versus Puerto Rico? And that's not criticizing the people or the commitment of the fans from either countries, but I think you're going, you know, I've been lucky. I've managed to attend a few World Cups, and they've been fantastic experiences. And you meet loads of people, but the vast majority of the fans attending are from the bigger countries with bigger fan bases. And, you know, some of the smaller countries, I think they might struggle to sell out their allocations.
Although I'm still convinced that broadcasting wise, I still think there's room for another time. And without ever stopping the Andorras of this world, the Puerto Ricos of this world, from taking part in the World Cup if they can, I still think if you want another tournament every 2 years, have a tournament where it's those countries play. I would watch it. I think people all over the world would happily watch those teams getting a chance to actually win something. That, whether it makes money for FIFA is the big problem. But yeah, from FIFA to UEFA, Kieran, and England's next UEFA match will be played behind closed doors. Arguably, some people say we're lucky to get only a one-match ban. How much will this cost the FA?
Yeah, I mean, it's one match plus, you know, they're on the naughty step, aren't they? There's another one which is sort of a suspended sentence hanging over them. I think this is not good news for England. They would normally make somewhere in the region of £4 to 5 million from a sold out Wembley. Now the next home match is against Albania. At the same time, you know, we are aware that England have not yet qualified, and it's an opportunity to get that much closer to the World Cup. And England fans are pretty amazing that they will turn out in numbers to watch what you might consider to be relatively moderate opposition over whom you would normally expect a relatively straightforward victory. So the FA has had a tough period of time. It's it lost money on the back of COVID, which was understandable. There's the potential job losses at FA as well. So this is going to hit them in the coffers, and at a time when it can't afford to. And unfortunately, and people saying, is this anything to do with the pretty reprehensible behaviour of some of the Hungarian fans at the last the match at Wembley? It's not. This goes back to the final of the European Championships, where unfortunately some of our fans decided to behave like bellends.
We're all aware of the phrase extraordinary general meeting, but the Premier League this week had an extraordinary emergency meeting, which ended up in a vote amid some animosity, Kieran. Tell us all about this, as I know the chairman of my own club, Crystal Palace, featured quite heavily in it.
Yes. The Premier League clubs, I think it's fair to say, they were unhappy with what has happened with regards to the takeover of Newcastle United. And I think in particular with the speed of events. There was the CAT meeting, effectively the court case with regards to some of Mike Ashley's issues. And once the Premier League were given assurances that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and PIF, from a legal perspective, are separate legal bodies, and people, we've received criticism of it that we've not gone too hard on this, but unfortunately, the law is the law. It is a rule-based system, but there is legal separation of power and control between the two bodies. That the Newcastle deal went through with amazing speed. And I think that caught the Premier League and some of the clubs on the hop. And I think it's also fair to say that they are pretty hacked off, quite a few of the clubs, with the performance to date of Gary Hoffman, who is the chairman of the Premier League, his future is open to question. There hasn't been a vote of no confidence yet, would appear to be the case, but I think he's got to win over an awful lot of clubs. So and by all accounts, all of the clubs received was the equivalent of a text: oh, by the way, Newcastle have just been taken over by PIF. And that was, they got a short email, no explanation, no justification as to why the deal had gone through or why the Premier League itself had approved it so quickly. So in terms of this extraordinary meeting, an extraordinary, it is by all accounts what was happening. It was Steve Parish was taking the role of Red Robbo. So people who are under 60 years old are now scratching their heads. Google British Leyland from the 1970s if you really want to do that. But the ruling that has been introduced is that you cannot have sponsorship with any party to which you have a pre-existing relationship. Now, this is a temporary ban on such relationships. Newcastle see it as a witch hunt. They point out that when Manchester City were acquired by Sheikh Mansour, Etihad Airways very quickly had a sponsorship arrangement. So why can't Newcastle United have arrangements? I think the Premier League clubs are fearful that Newcastle United will announce either a naming rights deal, which I'm not convinced about myself. It is St James's Park, and it will always be, I think, in the hearts of Newcastle fans, or some form of very lucrative sponsorship deal. That's their way of sort of literally sticking a spoke in the wheel of such deals going through. Now, the reason why it's only temporary is to give the Premier League and the clubs who are unhappy a bit of breathing space into which they can perhaps change the constitution of the Premier League to try to prevent Newcastle's commercial income increasing rapidly. Presently, it's around about £28-29 million. Now, it's lower than that of my club, Brighton. And no disrespect to us or Newcastle. Newcastle are a much bigger club than we are. They've got a lot more history and heritage. They've been in the Premier League for the vast majority of its existence. And we're new kids on the block. So I think Newcastle underperformed spectacularly from a commercial perspective under Mike Ashley. There are clubs that have got 8 to almost 10 times as much commercial income as Newcastle, and they seem to resent the potential for Newcastle to catch up. So I anticipate there will be an attempt to rewrite the rules as to what you can and cannot do with regards to sponsorship income. And this will give the Premier League an opportunity to get its lawyers working overtime over the course of the next few weeks to try to come up with something to prevent such relationships taking place between Newcastle and potential sponsors and commercial partners in the Middle East.
There are still details emerging, Kieran, about details of what happened at what was apparently a very, very bad-tempered meeting. But my understanding is it was Newcastle who called the meeting in the first place at very short notice to present a fait accompli to the other Premier League clubs in terms of a lucrative sponsorship deal that was already lined up. Is that true?
That could be the case. We're not quite sure on that. I certainly think Newcastle have not helped themselves because, by all accounts, they went into the meeting. Lee Charnley, who is effectively, you know, Mike Ashley's fall guy at the club, along with Steve Bruce. You know, they are very much seen as Ashley yes men. By the fan base, which isn't necessarily the case, I think in the case of Steve Bruce in particular. But they went into the meeting, and the first thing they did, they threatened the Premier League if the Premier League tried to try to prevent such deals. And then they said, everybody in this room, if you vote against us, well, we think it's anti-competitive, and we will take on you effectively on a club-by-club basis as well. So, yeah, they went in too aggressively. Perhaps the clubs who were angry should have said, we need to have a conversation. I think it's a pretty poor show by the new owners that they sent Lee Charnley. You know, if there are new owners there, why couldn't they have attended themselves and presented their position rather than somebody whose future isn't necessarily going to be there for very long? So neither side is coming out of this with a huge amount of credit. Newcastle, perhaps, if they were thinking of taking on the Premier League and the other clubs legally. Yeah, sometimes it's good if you're playing a game of poker even, not to play your big cards first. Talking is better than, you know, we've spoken to lawyers on the show. They've always said mediation, negotiation is far better than a confrontation in a court.
Well, we're playing Newcastle on Saturday, so that's going to be a spicy boardroom halftime. And also, I'm fairly certain, knowing Palace, that we'll discover that Newcastle's temporary coach in charge for one game is the greatest motivator the world's ever seen. And they get their only 3 points. And to those people, by the way, there were people who accused us of a lack of moral outrage when we covered the Newcastle story. Those people probably haven't been listening to the pod right from the start, to be perfectly honest. And all we pointed out was that we are very much against the Saudi takeover, but there are 8 or 9 clubs in the Premier League who are also very much against their ownership as well, and several clubs in the Championship and many clubs in League One and League Two. And that whilst it's legal and possible for these people to take over clubs like Newcastle, there's not a lot we can do and except carry on campaigning for it to stop, to be perfectly honest. Better news for the Premier League, though, Kieran, is a huge wad of cash is on the way. An Uncle Terry-sized wad of cash is on the way to Premier League clubs through the upcoming US TV rights auction.
Yes. At present, the Premier League is in the final year of a 6-year deal with NBC. I think it paid around about £116 million for the first 3 years, and then it was upped to £150 at present. The Premier League is very, very popular in the US. It's second only to the Mexican League in terms of football, in terms of popularity, and the Mexican League is huge because, you know, clearly there's a huge Hispanic population in the US itself, and I think we might be returning to Mexico a bit later as well. But what the Premier League has been, I think, quite clever at doing is offering the US broadcasters a long-term deal. So if you take a look at the NFL deal, you know, that's for about 9 or 11 years, and it allows the TV companies to invest in studios, to invest in infrastructure on that side of the water, in the knowledge that it's going to be used for a long time. So it could be up to 9 years, and it could be worth up to $3 billion if the Premier League manages to persuade people to buy rather than the full rights, but to split the rights. So, you know, it could be that you know, the UEFA matches will go to one TV company, the Premier League matches will be split into a couple of packages. You might be able to get Amazon involved as well, because Amazon are absolutely delighted with their relationship with the Premier League domestically. It's been very lucrative from their point of view of signing up new people from Amazon Prime, and Amazon Prime, for, you know, I think for anybody who has become involved with it as on that subscription basis, where you get your free deliveries and so on. Yeah, it's a bit like Hotel California. You can never leave because it's actually, you know, and there are lots of things we could also say from a moral and ethical and a workforce perspective about Amazon, but that's not really the right show for it, which we don't cover it in great light. It's very efficient at what it does, and I'll say no more than that. So, you know, the benefits, the US broadcasters also like the fact that the people who watch football in the US, they tend to be younger. They may often have more disposable income, which is attractive to you know, advertisers. So they see the benefits, and the football, you know, it still trails way behind the NFL in terms of popularity, but it does now appear to have, you know, nipped ahead of hockey. Ice hockey as a TV viewing sport. It's got to do some catching up with baseball and the NBA as well, but it's moving forwards, and it's seen now as a significant number four in terms of the benefits of having the broadcast rights.
And talking of American money, Kieran, it's almost like Guy's put a modicum of effort into the running order this week. I have to say, American TV companies do cover sport well, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. They really do put the effort behind it. An American finance and technology firm has invested in Wolves.
Yes, this is a company called Peak Six. And what they've done is they've bought a stake in Fosun, who are the Chinese owners of Wolves. But they do have a bit of history in football. They were involved in Irish football. They used to own Dundalk. I think that was not a successful relationship from one of the two tweets that I've seen around. And they then ended up, for some reason, buying 25% of Bournemouth and then selling it back to the owner, Maximum Denim, or something like that. but
it's what you used to work here, isn't it, in the old days?
Absolutely, yes. It looks like they're dipping their toes in. Certainly, talking to people from the US, they do see English football as being undervalued. It also, I think, is further indication that Chinese owners have lost an element of enthusiasm for football here in Europe in terms of ownership. And that's come sort of directly or indirectly from guidance from the Chinese government. And, you know, there's always a close relationship between Chinese governments and individual companies. So whether this is going to result in a larger stake in due course, we're not sure. But the fact that it's sort of a finance and technology company is perhaps indicative of where football is heading. It is seen as a financial product. Cryptocurrency and NFTs, which we have spoken about, they are using football as sort of the bridgehead into acceptance. It could be connected with one of those things as well.
You actually anticipated, Kieran, what I thought was a very clever Nobody else would have asked this question, but clearly you were straight there before me, because I was going to ask whether this is anything to do with the Chinese government encouraging, shall we say, their businesses to divest themselves of their interest in European football. So clearly it is.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, Fosun, when they first acquired Wolves, spent an awful lot of money. And that spending has become more modest. I think it's noticeable in the last couple of years. You know, they do have that very close relationship, Fosun, with Jorge Mendes, the super agent, and he has been able to utilize his connections to make some fantastic signings for Wolves. There's no doubt about that. But whether that degree of enthusiasm is now starting to wane is open to question.
It's been a difficult season, year, decade for Oldham Athletic, as we've reflected on this pod recently. And it's not getting any easier, is it, this week?
No. Oldham were subject to an embargo from the EFL. And this was a strict application of rules. And if we want sustainable football, then the EFL are duty-bound to do this. So Oldham were under an embargo, which effectively restricted them to recruiting talent in terms of free transfers and loans only. But it now appears that there is an additional embargo, which is going to be applied by the club, that they will be able to make no signings whatsoever. So this is the EFL coming down much stricter. And this is because of a failure to pay another club. Now, I don't know whether this is a loan fee. I would be surprised if it was a transfer fee, given that Oldham have been feeding on scraps for some time. But at a time when the club is at the wrong end of the football pyramid, I think the manager, Keith Curl, is operating with one hand behind his back, as of course are many other managers at clubs. It's going to further inflame what is already a fairly toxic relationship between the fan base. I speak to, I often have messages from organisations such as Push the Boundary at Oldham who are unhappy with what's happening. So you can understand their position as fans. They have been trying to protest in a variety of ways to make sure that their feelings are known. The owner says, I put in 5 million quid into the club, but what quite often we see it's was talking about Scunthorpe recently. It's not necessarily the money that you put in. And this is going back to the listener Barry who'd sent in the question. It's how you spend it as well as how much you spend, and it's not been spent well, and they have had a fairly rotating door policy with regards to managers, which is normally a sign of things which are not good on the pitch.
Don't keep mentioning Barry's name. He's had his go.
There's not many bad Barrys in the world, are there? Barry Chuckle, Barry from EastEnders.
Oh, that's true.
Barry Manilow.
Barry Fryer. Barry Town. That's a football club. Yeah. Doesn't count.
Barry George isn't good, but...
Moving on. Is there a reason, Kieran? Is it EFL policy that they will announce that a club has breached an EFL rule, but they won't announce the detail of what rule they've breached?
No, I think they have... that they do have a new page on the website in their governance section, which is great. It's improved transparency in terms of what they do show. So now there is a list of every single club which is under embargo, and also the reasons for it. So it could be non-repayment of outstanding loans, or they could have what they refer to as monitored loans. It could be for potential breaches of the profitability and sustainability rules, non-payment of wages, and so on. So, you know, I think this is something which is to be applauded, because we've been shouting about we want improved transparency, and now I think it's a step up. It would perhaps be even better if it was more prominent, but you know, if you have to dig into the small print, then so be it.
I tell you who is a Barry the decorator from Porson's Arms.
Oh, right.
He's a lovely Barry. He's probably the nicest Barry I know. You met him. AKA Frank Talking and Against Modern Football.
Yes.
He has many aliases, but Barry the decorator, he's a lovely Barry.
Yeah, my Uncle Terry has many aliases as well.
Of course he had. One of whom could be Barry. Maybe Barry the decorator is the Uncle Terry. Yes. Maybe that's why he was so keen to meet you. Back to Mexico, which is a phrase I rarely get to use in any of my many years in the broadcasting industry. Back to Mexico. 17 Mexican clubs have been fined after being found guilty of colluding in the women's player drafts.
Yes. This is quite an unpleasant tale. Women's football in Mexico is a recent phenomenon from a professional point of view. The Women's Soccer League was formed in 2016. It then turns out that there were all of these clubs, I think the phrase Mexico and cartel are quite often used in the same sentence. But it looks as if these 17 clubs had formed a cartel, and the first thing that they did was that they created an informal wage cap. I did a bit of digging around, and this is quite horrendous. The original wage cap was between £5 and £20 per week.
Whoa, what?
Yeah, this is horrendous. But you've got young women in Mexico. They as we know, Mexico's a football crazy country. The clubs thought, well, this is an opportunity to make money from seeing the play. So now, admittedly, the cartel increased this, and I think it then went up to £100 per week by the time we got to 2019. But there was this gentleman's agreement that they would not transfer players from one club to another. So even if you were out of contract, you couldn't go and find yourself another club. You either had to accept a pretty low salary, or alternatively, you don't get to play football. And for an embryonic sport in terms of its professionalism, it meant that these people, these poor women were not being properly rewarded. Then there was further tales came out that as far as sort of the apprentices were concerned, the women players who were 16 to 17 years old, they weren't paid at all, and they were effectively just giving food and lodgings. These clubs are saying, if you want to play football for us, we're going to give you nothing. We'll feed you. That's as far as it goes. So it's pretty horrendous. So the clubs between them, they were fined 177 million peso, which I think is in the region of £7 million. So, I think it is a serious fine from the Mexican, anti-competitive behavior authorities, and that has to be applauded. 8 individuals were also included in the fines, but they have not been named. South American football, Central American football, fantastic. It's great to watch it from an outsider's perspective, but this story I think is reflects very poorly on the clubs that are running the game.
Well, it certainly does, and you can't help feeling, I mean, exploitation is a word that comes to mind, because women's football is no different to men's football in countries like Mexico, where so many of the players come from poor areas of terrible poverty. So the owners of these clubs will be thinking to themselves, to these women, £10-20 is actually quite a lot of money. We don't have to offer them any more. So there is that element there. It's a story we should keep an eye on. It's not, as you say, it's not a savoury story by any means. We've got two more stories to go, Kieran, before our interview. This one, I know it's probably a serious story, Kieran, but I'm going to struggle to say it without laughing, because I laughed when I read the email from Kieran. from Guy, rather. it's just an image that made me laugh. The catering staff at the Camp Nou can't use the ovens because it might overload the stadium's power. I'm sorry, I don't know why this is so funny. It's just a proper carry-on thing. It's just like, catering staff at the new Camp Nou, whatever, can't use the ovens in case it overloads the stadium. It's just the image of the floodlights going out halfway through the Champions League semi-final. So, oh, someone's put the oven on. What are you doing? We'll have the food afterwards. Yes, it's a strange... I mean, this is... And we talked about Barcelona's financial problems, Kieran, but this is one of the biggest clubs in the world and they can't put the oven on.
Yes, and it's indicative of... A club which has been spending the pounds or spending the euros, but not looking after the infrastructure, not looking after the fabric of the club, because it's got itself into such a financial pickle. And I would thoroughly recommend for anybody, take a look at our very good friend, the Swiss Ramble. He's done a fantastic summary of the state of Barcelona's finances, and they are in a huge mess. It's not stopping them from trying to expand the stadium because that's the nature, I think, of these giant clubs, that they think that they are immune. But the fact that there were all of these problems taking place on an operational level, on a day-to-day basis, whilst the club was making grand pronouncements left, right and centre, is a true reflection of the financial mismanagement that has taken place at Barcelona Football Club. And also, you know, in my view, the presidential model, which encourages people to promise to spend huge sums of money on players, but of course nothing will be said about how the club is organizing itself as a business, you know, in terms of just doing the things which happens in every company. Yeah, if your canteen's not working, then you've got a problem.
And finally, Kieran, very sad news for fans of Preston North End and for fans of National Hunt horse racing.
Yes, this is the passing of Trevor Hemmings, who was the owner of Preston North End. He was a pretty benevolent owner, and I mean, historically, as you know, I monitor every club. Trevor Hemmings was putting in £6, £7, £8 million of his own money to subsidise the club on an annual basis, and he's done that for most of the last decade. And yeah, I used to get. Well, I didn't used to get the stick, but he used to get stick when I used to summarise what was taking place. You know, some of the Preston fans, and it has to be stressed, only a minority, were saying, well, he's not putting enough money in. But it is now a cause for concern. Now, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in terms of the club's future, but if you are reliant upon one person to provide funding and that one person is no longer there, where is the £7 or £8 million of subsidy that's going to be required by the summer of 22? You know, it could be that the club will have a legacy from his estate. We don't know that. It could be that family members will take over his role. But as we saw, and it does appear to be a common feature of clubs in the Northwest, when if we take a look at what happened with Eddie Davis at Bolton Wanderers, where when his health deteriorated, he'd put in £175 million. He says, you know, for the sake of my health, I need to divest of myself of the club. Problems arose on the back of that. You know, Preston actually run a reasonably tight ship, but you know, they're trying to compete in the Championship, which, you know, is our car crash football division. So you know, one hopes that there is going to be some continued financial support for the club, but until that uncertainty is dealt with, then there is a cause for concern.
Yeah, I think as well, as a sign of respect, we will leave it a couple of weeks before we look more closely at where it leaves Preston. But he's definitely a great loss to National Hunt Racing. He was the owner of three Grand National winners, and he was always tremendous value. I've seen him a couple of times in person and many times on TV. When one of his horses won a race, he was very good to cut to afterwards, let's put it that way. It's interview time, Kieran. Many of the stories we report on are crucial, vital, life-changing, but one story really is all of those things, because we can't play football if the world is hotter than a Barcelona oven on occasion, or our grounds are underwater. So we spoke to Tom Rawson, head of sustainability at Football for Future, about the beautiful game and its relationship with the beautiful planet.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Tom, hello. Thank you for joining us. First of all, Tom, tell us a little bit about your own football history, who you support, etc. The only reason I ask is because we had an interview a few months ago where someone's hidden affiliation to a certain club in Sussex was revealed halfway through, and it just threw the rest of the interview, Tom, so I don't want to take that risk.
Yeah, well, I am a Burnley fan.
Oh, that's all right.
Good. Yeah, my accent doesn't give that away, but my dad's from Burnley. I run a London-based supporters club for Burnley.
Oh, that's great. Your dad being from there is one of the best things. I used to get quite cross with, you know, people who dismiss all Man United fans, because you should only dismiss some of them, because some of them do have links with the town, basically, and quite often it's for appearance. So that's how many of you are in the London-based Burnley supporters club?
Well, it's kind of covers London and the broader southern region, and some of Burnley probably as well.
Okay, and you're sort of having the same sort of season as we are. You're playing all right, but you're not getting many points, are you?
Yeah, there are some good signs. I mean, yeah, we've been in this position before, so I still have full confidence that Dyche is the man to turn it around.
Yeah, do you know what? I wish this was a football pod sometimes, because I'd love to talk to you about Sean Dyche, because I'm amazed he didn't come to Palace. But it's not, Tom. We have more important things to talk about. I'm aware, Tom, that every question I ask you about such a serious subject could sound significant and possibly doom-laden, but hopefully we'll all be more optimistic by the end of this process. But right at the top of the Football for Future mission statement, you talk of raising awareness of the relationship between football and climate change. What is that relationship?
Yes, exactly. So the relationship between football and climate change it's twofold. On one hand, football is vulnerable to climate change. There's obviously a game that's played in outdoor conditions where extreme weather events, whether that be flooding or whether that be heating, can affect potentially the welfare of players and fans and the logistics of the game, the safety of the conditions. So on one hand, it's vulnerable, but on the other hand, football is a significant contributor to climate change and has a, I don't think anyone really knows how huge football's carbon footprint is, but there's no doubt that it's significant, probably the size of a small country. So it's both vulnerable and a contributor.
Is that just English football you're talking about there that has that giant carbon footprint?
Well, both. I mean, yeah, football in England, the Premier League, but obviously football worldwide has a huge carbon footprint, yeah.
Well, okay. Well, I want to come on to those climate extremes in a bit more detail in a moment. But in our introduction, we talked about Football for Future. Is every one of your founding team an expert in climate and sustainability, or do you have football fans and other people on the board?
Yeah, I think the one thing that does bring us all together is that we are football fans, and probably more than that, all believe in football as a force for good and a force for social change. But yeah, the team's made up of climate scientists and sustainability experts, but also equally important, you know, creatives and communicators, and you know, we're a team that can you know, hopefully get those messages in across in a way that taps into football culture and is kind of tangible to the football community.
And you've got one of football's best historians involved as well, haven't you?
Exactly. The legend David Goldblatt is Football Future chairman.
One of our listeners, and this is partly the reason we decided we had to talk to you and talk to you quick, Tom, is one of our listeners told us of that chilling report that 23 football grounds could be underwater by the year 2050 if we carry on the way we're going. A, is that true? And B, please tell me there's a way we can stop that happening.
Yeah, this was a report written by David Goldblatt himself. The findings of that report were that 23 out of 92, so almost a quarter of English men's football league clubs will be susceptible to total or partial annual flooding by 2050. So some of the grounds involved: St Mary's, Carrow Road, Stamford Bridge, the Olympic Stadium.
The Amex?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So every cloud. Can we stop? I mean, I want to come on to some practical things that you can tell us, but I think people do need hope. People want to do things, but they also want to do things thinking that there's still a chance to make this change. So we can. We've got time. We've still got time. I mean, it's really odd. That's less time away than Gaza crying, basically. But have we got time to change this, Tom?
Yes, I think every football fan knows how important a last minute winner is. And
say
we're deep into Fergie time. Sorry to bring that up.
That's harsh.
It's too soon. We are deep into Fergie time, but that doesn't mean it's game over.
Right. Before I ask what clubs can do, we've been asked, so since we announced that we were going to talk to you, so many fans have contacted us to say, what can we do on a personal level to help stop this? Because, you know, fans are, they have such goodwill. They really want to help. But sometimes the problem seems so vast, they think that their small effort, like, you know, I walk to the ground, but that's only because I can. Mm. But it doesn't occur to me that small effort is actually going to make any difference, even make a tiny dent. But what can fans do?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, partly that element of being, you know, it seeming too big of a problem is, you know, firstly, partly the role that Football for Future are trying to play in making this issue tangible and making it real to everyday life and the experience of the football community. I think that there are two elements there, and it's, as you correctly raised, you know, fans can only do what's within, you know, act within the choices available to them. So, fans are a part of this, and fan choices are important. But having those choices in place in through clubs and through football, you know, from the football industry and wider in society and in the economy, is what will give fans the ability to make those good choices. Like, for example, public transport: is it possible? Is it affordable?
Hmm. Well, in Germany, again, they're ahead of us because most match day tickets come with a local transport ticket attached as well, which, you know, encourages people to get public transport rather than drive, which is something we could really adopt here, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, something else that Brighton do very well.
Yeah, I'll pretend you didn't say that. What about clubs? I mean, obviously, clubs are in a much better position to do stuff on a bigger scale than fans are. So what are clubs doing, and are they willing to talk to you when you approach them?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And again, that's a key part of what we offer, is to support clubs in starting off this journey. A lot of, you know, what clubs can do is directly within their control. So addressing their impact in terms of their carbon footprint, the waste that they create, and how they manage their kind of local environment. But there's also, you know, clubs have this wider role of communication. You know, lots of clubs are making good progress kind of behind the scenes, but a lack of communication means that it doesn't make it tangible, and it doesn't allow fans to get on this journey. So it's that important thing of both addressing your impact, but also communicating well about what sustainability is.
I'm really interested in what fans can practically do, Tom. Is there a sense that it's almost too late to reach out to my generation. You know, we've caused this problem in the first place. Is it better to concentrate on reaching out to a younger generation who seem to me to far more clearly understand the implications than perhaps my generation does?
Well, hopefully, you know, talking in the language of football makes this tangible and accessible to all football fans. The Football Future team were outside Wembley early this year ahead of the England-Croatia game, and you know, engaging with fans who were overwhelmingly concerned about climate change, supporting clubs in taking action, and also really positive about the idea of players speaking out and using their platform to do good.
I'll come on to that in a moment. You acknowledge yourself, Tom, on your website, that there is a lot of negativity in the climate change conversation, especially as so many media outlets, to their shame, still present this as overprivileged kids stopping you from getting to work by gluing themselves to things. And it's that's the narrative we're presented with. How do you change that? How do you get an element of positivity around a subject as difficult as this when so many people in the media are refusing to even engage with it? You know, the shocking way that people refer to Greta Thunberg, older people who should know better. And it's like, that's as far as the debate gets. It's shut down. So how do we change that?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think I'm a very optimistic person. I try not to let the comment section get in the way of what can be done and represent what public opinion might be. And I think, you know, broadly we are seeing fans and the football community and the football industry really keen to get on board and start this journey, but sometimes intimidated by what it means, not quite understanding the terminology, or don't know where to start fundamentally, which is I think what something that we can really unlock.
And this is a question that I will bring Kieran in on, Tom, because of course football clubs are businesses. So how do you persuade them that money spent now is a wise investment for the future, when the chances are that somebody else will probably own the club in 10 years' time anyway? In a way that it's almost impossible to get governments to invest in the future, because it won't be them that gets the credit now.
Yeah, I think that question, what is the cost? I think it's important to reframe that maybe as to, you know, what's the cost of not doing anything? And we've spoken about how vulnerable football can be to extreme weather that climate change brings. But also, you know, what's the opportunity? And, you know, organizations more widely are really picking up sustainability and the journey to net zero as an opportunity for growth, an opportunity for understanding where efficiencies can be made within their organization, and you know, an opportunity to change culture and bring a sense of, you know, a new kind of purpose to the core of what the organization is, which, you know, if you think about future investors, future supporters, sponsors, and maybe even players, you know, we'll be looking at these things and looking at the values that a club represents and what a club stands for, and potentially making a decision, you know, does that reflect my values?
Kieran, do you think clubs are more likely to spend the money it's going to take if, for example, the government were to incentivize them to do that? I mean, if there was a tangible reward now, do you think that's more likely to, or do you have to play on a club's level of responsibility?
I think clubs are taking steps forward. Yeah, we did have the Chelsea Spurs match, which was the first carbon zero game. We've got the likes of Sky committing themselves to carbon efficiencies, and also it's actually in the interests of clubs. In a short term, you view it as an investment. Infrastructure spending, which might be associated with this, is allowable for financial fair play purposes. So, you know, that's not going to stop them from spending money elsewhere. And if you are a club owner and you are thinking in 5 or 10 years' time, I want to be in a position to sell this club, well, you also want a sport which is capable of being played in 92 grounds. So there's an element of self-interest in committing to some form of financial investment, but also ethical investment in these activities. And the thing is, the costs are actually far lower than many people actually realize. I think there's a fear because if it costs something, then that's more than nothing, but you can still get a return on that investment financially, because you're making cost savings by investing in heat pumps instead of using gas heating for the changing rooms and some of the facilities. You can get grants, so there is positivity here.
Well, also, Tom, I mean, simple things like collecting rainwater for irrigation. I mean, that can't be that expensive, can it?
Yeah, there's so much that that a club can implement. And yeah, I think to think of everything, sustainability actions as being big investments or big infrastructure projects is that's only part of what it means. If you think about what products you buy and how environmentally friendly they are and the kind of carbon footprint behind them. Just like a very, very simple example of challenging suppliers, does every single jersey, every single piece of merchandise that arrives at the club shop, is it individually wrapped in plastic? And, then therefore, does it need to be? And asking those kinds of questions doesn't create cost. It just creates, a more sustainable kind of culture around the club.
Well, do you know what? It's interesting you say that, Tom. Our very first home game this season, there was a fantastic display put on by the Homesdale Fanatics. Brilliant. And the whole ground was covered in red and blue flags. But so many fans around us and after the game were wondering whether these plastic flags were sustainable. Mm. And which I thought was interesting. I think 2 years ago, I don't think people would even have considered that. So clearly the message is getting through. You mentioned players, Tom, and in the context of extreme weather, those players that are lucky enough or unlucky enough to play at the World Cup in Qatar are going to discover, probably for the first time, what playing in extreme weather conditions actually means. Are you finding that players who are, clearly for the most part young, and you think more aware of this situation, are players more easy to get to on this subject than clubs, perhaps?
I think they're also, also part of the solution and part of the voice and part of the platform that needs to be tapped into. I mean, the influence of football players in particular, I think if you look at the top social media accounts for sports people in general, then the top three are Neymar, Messi and Ronaldo. They're footballers. Mm. So the reach of players is really significant. Another one of our board members is Katie Root, who's a footballer for Southampton in New Zealand, and she's used her platform throughout her career to talk about environmental issues. We're working with a Wickham footballer called David Wheeler. Players like Patrick Bamford, Mo Salah, Chris Smalling have all used their platforms to speak out and say something about this issue. And I think it's a trend that's increasing.
I want to talk about your work with Hanwell Town in a moment. But there is a league club that you presumably admire a lot in Forest Green Rovers. How important is it for you to have a living example of what can be done currently out there?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, Forest Green Rovers are a great model and great exemplar, and almost create this kind of magnet effect of being, okay, they're all the way over there, but, it at least defines, where the journey is. And I think gives clubs an equivalent pathway to a journey to begin. And Forest Green Rovers are a great example as well, not just on the fact that they are sustainable, but they're balancing sustainability with punching above their weight in terms of international fan base, in terms of sponsorship, and in terms of league position performance.
Yeah, we'll be talking to their owner in a few weeks' time. The only problem is with Forest Green, and I'm as guilty of this as anyone, Tom, is that you stand back and you admire what they're doing, these brilliant practical things that they're doing, and then somebody says, well, there's no burgers, and you go, oh, crikey, that's a problem. So there are all sorts of almost comedy hurdles that you have to get over that you might, some of the more traditional match day experiences might have to disappear, mightn't they?
Yeah, on the April Fool's Day this year, they announced that they were introducing meat detectors before you go into the game. So, yeah, I think they can play that game as well, maybe.
Yeah. Hanwell Town in the Southern League, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, the Isthmian South Central.
Isthmian South Central, okay. Hanwell Town, I really regret having to say this, but Hanwell Town joined Arsenal in becoming only the second London club to commit to becoming a net zero carbon football club. And you are now their chief sustainability officer, the first of its kind position in the whole world of football. How did both of those things come about and how is it working?
Yes, well, I reached out to Nigel Hunt, who's the CEO of Hanwell Town. They're already doing great things. And, from our conversation, it was clear that sustainability was on their mind as well as, a great opportunity to move the club forward. So the UN Sports for Climate Action Framework, which was the first step we took, is a voluntary commitment that any club can make that commitment to kind of get them started on that journey. And, a handful of Premier League clubs have done so. Clubs at any level can do it. Shoreham, another non-league club, have committed. So that's a great thing for clubs to be part of. And we took the opportunity while the league was kind of postponed and suspended to take a really close look at how the club was run and what the environmental performance was like and where the sustainability opportunities were. Kind of created an environmental strategy which set out across carbon, waste and nature what Hanwell could do and hopefully kind of set up a model that other clubs can follow. And there's lots of challenges at non-league level. It's a club run by volunteers. We're now back into the season, but we're getting those foundations set up to now got a sustainability subcommittee as part of the committee structure. And last month they upgraded their floodlights to LED floodlights. That results in a 45% reduction in carbon, which means energy, which means cost. So another great example of what can be done.
Well, and how much did that cost them?
The payback is around 10 years, but there is a payback.
Right. So, I mean, Kieran, it strikes me that if a club like Hanwell can do that, then the clubs in the 90s or 91, including excluding Forest Green, have got no excuse for not doing that, have they?
I think if they are shown the benefits, then there will be a greater take up. I think the clubs will also, in their defence, they have to satisfy certain levels of luminescence to have HD cameras on the facility. So there might be some pushback. But what we are seeing is continual progression in terms of energy efficiency from alternative means. And that can only be a positive because clubs are aware that they are organisations that want to be in existence on a long-term basis, and you can't do that if you're underwater. So, it's in their interests, and I'm sure that they will have done the sums. Coming out of COVID, everybody's very sensitive about costs, but if you put forward a persuasive case, then clubs will buy into it.
Tom, since you started this project, which is going to be a long-term one, obviously, are you already more or less optimistic about what football can do about its future?
I am very optimistic about the way that that this journey within football is really kind of starting to land, and starting to become very real in terms of seeing action from clubs and from broadcasters and around the football industry, and also the response from the football community and fans. I think it's something that is just beginning, but it's something that's really taking off, and there's so many really promising signs.
I think Kieran and I are always mystified as to why this pod does so well, but I think part of the reason is that we try and reflect how brilliant the football community, however you define the football community, and let's say fans and players and football clubs as a loose start, but we always try and reflect what good things the football community do and how, in general, despite what the media might have you think, they are a positive, forward-thinking bunch of people who, if you explain to them why there's a problem, they will respond to that problem. They'll do something about it. So what is there one thing that individual football fans listening to this, Tom, who will want to do their bit without a doubt, is there one thing they can do for you, for your organisation? And is there one thing they can do? Is there one small change they can make in their match day routine that they can do and feel better about what they're doing to help the climate?
Yeah, 100%. I think what's important is that it's you don't need, you know, environmentally perfect football fans. You know, like one out of 60,000, you need 60,000 imperfect, environmentally imperfect football fans. So, clear example is obviously travel to games, and probably about 70% of football's carbon footprint is due to travel. So,
as much travel, as that,
yeah. It's really significant. So traveling in more sustainable ways, whether that's walking and cycling, or taking public transport, or just arranging coaches or car share arrangements, anything to avoid single occupancy cars, I think is the one main thing that fans can take away.
Well, presumably that's a small change that clubs can make as well, isn't it, in terms of how they get to games? I think it's one of our listeners pointed out, there's a lot of football teams going on a lot of flights in domestic games. You know, there's a lot of teams flying from London to Newcastle, and perhaps they should be going by train or coach.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, that kind of level of decision-making and where sustainability sits as a priority, should ideally be up there and be significant in the decisions that a club makes like that.
And is there anything individual fans can do for your organisation?
Well, what I'd say is any fans who want to work together, and anyone who's involved with clubs, please do reach out to us and follow us on Instagram at FTBL for future, or Google Football for future, and get in contact.
Well, I can guarantee that one response to this, Tom, and I know this from personal experience in the 2 years we've been doing the pod, is that we will be inundated with responses from people who are already doing things off their own back. And we will happily share those. And we will happily share anything that you want us to do in future, because I don't think there's a more important issue in football than this one. It does feel like we've hit a crucial period. It does feel like, for the first time, even people like me, I thought I'm the classic Guardian reading liberal. I've always been aware of these things without ever thinking that it's something I should be doing something about. And I think there are millions of us who feel that way, who now suddenly feel, no, actually, it's time we all stepped forward and did whatever it took. You know, it's fine that we all, you know, put the rubbish in separate bins, but, you know, it's time we all started to do more, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's a time to be very optimistic.
Well, that's a brilliant note to end. Thank you so much for talking to us, Tom. And as I say, if there's anything we can do to help publicise your campaigns in the future, we will happily do that.
That's amazing. And yeah, really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
I mean, it's a really interesting interview, Kieran, and it's certainly not going to be the first time we visit this most important of all stories, let's face it. But what strikes me out of that is that, first of all, how it's interesting that smaller teams seem to be almost more willing to take on this subject than bigger teams at the moment. But yet, as you said, these are not huge capital investments we're talking about here for clubs to spend on becoming more sustainable, are they?
No. And you know, a lot of them are simple things which perhaps we're doing on an individual basis, you know, such as using rainwater, such as you know, a football pitch is a big piece of land. You know, can you start to extract heat from it in order to make yourself more efficient on a long-term basis? You know, could that actually, you know, provide the heating for either putting it back into the national grid, or alternatively, you know, being used elsewhere in the club. So you know, I think some clubs are looking at this on a progressive basis. I think the environmental, social, and governance principles are becoming more important. And then at the same time, you're hearing things such as, you know, Manchester United flying to Leicester to play a match at the weekend. I know what the M6 is like. It's pretty horrendous. So you can understand why they wouldn't necessarily be enthusiastic about using a coach. Could they have used a train? I guess from the club's point of view, they might be worried about getting mobbed at the station. And also Manchester to Leicester's not a good train ride, but aeroplanes use the most fuel taking off and landing, and you're not going to have much time on a 10-15 minute flight to even get the peanuts around.
No, and if there's 30 of them by train, they'll get a big group discount there as well. The Glazers would love that. At the risk of sounding flippant, Kieran, it's pouring with rain as we speak. Your lovely Sussex rainwater might be used well. It's going to take a lot of filtration before this South London rainwater's fit for any purpose, Kieran, really. It's not even doing the garden much good, to be perfect. The garden looks worse after a South London rain than it did before. This climate conversation is going to continue. What I would like to do as well is I really would like to ask our fans, our listeners all over the world, what they are doing or what their clubs are doing towards sustainability. Because I think there are probably ideas out there with some great imagination that people like Tom have yet to think of and could probably make use of. So I'd be really interested to hear, wherever you are in the world, and we know there are some areas in particular that are really suffering at the moment, I'd love to hear what you or your club can do. Because as I said to Tom, Kieran, it's individual action is often the most hard to take, because there's no discernible difference, is there? You kind of feel, I want to do the right thing, but it's not going to make a dent. But we do have to try and do the right thing. So anything any of our listeners can help us with, I would really like to hear. And also, if you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to Always Free to AirPod, then please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. Guy tells me I don't have to say /anymore, it's just /. But I'm a traditionalist, Kieran, I'm going to keep saying /. Thank you. Actually, I'd met Slash. He's a lovely fellow, Slash.
Oh, well.
I made him a cup. He said, I'd made him the best cup of tea he'd ever had.
That is a showbiz anecdote.
I've got more Slash anecdotes, if you like. But I couldn't think of anything else to say to him, so I just said, cup of tea, Slash. He went, yeah, I'd love a cup of tea. And he said, oh, that's really nice. I think it's probably the first cup of tea he's had that didn't have peyote in it for some time. Which is probably why he liked it so much. It's coming to something new, pot stars. How many peyotes? Just two? Stirred? All right, fine. And if you have a question you like answered on our show, then email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. We are aware there is a backlog of questions, but we will try and get to your question as quickly as we can, especially if it's about a topical issue. So that's questions@priceoffootball.com. And meantime, I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, once again, folks, thank you for all your support, and thank you for your reviews. We appreciate the good ones, and we try to take notice of the not so good ones as well. If you want to assist us and just get some good karma, if you can go to the Apple icon and give us 5 stars, doesn't matter what you write. You could say you'd rather the show was presented by Prince Andrew and Sarah Millican. I'd listen to that. I think that'd be a fantastic combination. It could take place in a Pizza Hut as well. So, other than that, I didn't really show enough respect for Trevor Emmings. There are more important things than money in football as well. So, admonishment to myself for that. But best wishes to all, and we will see you soon.
We will see you soon. Bye bye, everybody. The Price of Football. Price of Football.